One of the questions that has been raised in the wake of the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington last week is, why is it that, given the United States has so much in the way of intelligence gathering capacity, why is it that we didn't have any warning of these attacks? Is this indeed a case of failure of intelligence? That's the kind of issue we want to try to explore here this morning with our guest in this hour of Focus 580. We'll be speaking with James Bamford. He's an investigative reporter. He is the author of a book that was a national bestseller when it was published now a number of years ago, titled The Puzzle Palace, which was really the first extensive look inside the National Security Agency. This year, he has published a new book that builds on that work and takes it further. In fact, we talked about it not very long ago. That book is titled Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency, covering the period from the Cold War through the dawn of the new century. That's the subtitle of the book. It's published by Doubleday, by the way. It is out in bookstores, and it's quite interesting. You might want to take a look at it. Until recently, our guest James Bamford was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight with Peter Jennings. He has written investigative cover stories for The New York Times Magazine, The Washington Post Magazine, The Los Angeles Times Magazine. His home is in Washington, D.C., and we're very pleased that he agreed to spend some more time talking with us this morning. Of course, we talk. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Bamford, hello.
Yeah, hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us. We really appreciate you doing this, especially as it was rather short notice.
Oh, that's okay.
Let me just ask the general question to start, and that's a question I think that so many people are asking, and that is this here a failure of intelligence?
It's a monumental failure of intelligence. The first job of intelligence is not to provide the president with his morning brief or to provide information on what's going on in various capitals in the world. The first job of intelligence is to prevent an attack on the United States. And so in that case, it was certainly a monumental failure. It was a far worse failure than Pearl Harbor, because during the time leading up to Pearl Harbor, the intelligence agencies in the United States had managed to break the Japanese code, our potential adversary's code, and also intercepted its communications. So just prior to Pearl Harbor, the intelligence community at that point was able to intercept the key Japanese message, decipher it, and then get a warning out Pearl Harbor, and because of mechanical reasons and technical reasons, the weather conditions weren't conducive to send it electronically, and they had to send it by Western Union. It was late by an hour or a couple hours, so it missed getting there on time. But the point was that they were in the position where they were able to intercept the communications, break the codes, and get a warning out to Pearl Harbor, even though, like I said, it got there a bit late. In this case, there was no warning. We never had any ability to intercept the adversary's communications. We haven't been able to intercept bin Laden's communications for years, and we haven't, if he's using encrypted information, we haven't been able to break his codes, apparently. So not only did we not have a few hours' notice or a few days' notice or a few weeks' notice, we didn't have any notice that this was about to take place. So in addition to that, there were probably more than twice as many casualties in this attack than there were in Pearl Harbor. So, and the other point is that dealing with Japan at the time was a highly technological, industrialized country, and here you're dealing basically with cave dwellers. So, yeah, it was a monumental intelligence failure.
Why do you think that this failure occurred? I mean, is there anything specific that you can point to say, here's where we went wrong, or we weren't doing what we needed to be doing?
Well, there are a lot of reasons, basically. One of them is that for 50 years we've been preparing to fight an entirely different type of war. We had all kinds of warning indicators in place in case the Russians were about to launch a nuclear missile, or they were about to prepare their missile launchers for a possible launch. We had satellites in space. We had listening posts on the ground, all directed at listening for early launches of missiles, either from Russia or China or anyplace else. And in this case, we weren't dealing with highly technical, sophisticated people. So for 50 years, we've been sort of gearing for the wrong intelligence war. And during the last 10 years, since the end of the Cold War, the intelligence community, especially NSA, has been trying to change. I mean, trying to reorganize itself to fight this new type of war, especially in the last few years. The last couple of years, they've been trying very hard, and they've been working very diligently to try to do that, but it's very difficult. During the Cold War, the NSA, which is the premier agency for providing warning, because it provides 80% of the intelligence to the United States, and it's involved in, unlike satellites that take pictures, which see what's happening now, NSA provides warning on what's going to happen in the future because it eavesdrops on communications and breaks codes. Well, NSA had to go through this enormous change from listening to high-frequency communications, which is how the Russians communicated with their Army, Navy, and Air Force, to all of a sudden trying to eavesdrop on buried fiber-optic cables, which are very, very difficult. And I think the main problem here is that NSA has been collecting a fair amount of information, but the analysis part is the sort of Achilles heel here, because you can collect everything in the world, but if you don't have enough people to translate it or analyze it, then it's totally useless.
Yeah.
Just one example here, when the crisis in Haiti broke out, again, it caught most everybody by surprise, and NSA was able to intercept a fair amount of communications involving Haiti to and from Haitian government, but the problem was the entire agency had only one Creole linguist. So, and that's the problem here. I think you probably got a lot of former Russian linguists at NSA, but you don't have very many people that speak Pashto, Dari, Urdu, Farsi, a number of the other key languages in the area.
I'm sure that, Ed, that in the wake of these events that people will say that the problem is that particularly since the NSA, perhaps also the CIA, were so focused on the Cold War, and when the Cold War ended, that these agencies found themselves with less in the way of resources than they had before. And some people, I suppose, will argue that in fact we have crippled them by cutting back on money and staff and everything that they need to do their jobs. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, and I would basically agree with that, because the intelligence community is facing an enormously complicated technological problem right now. The world is flooded with information, and trying to pick this needle out of this enormous haystack of communications is extremely difficult. And like I said, you need analysts. If you want to do this right, you've got to get enough people that can understand the languages in the various crisis areas. You have to have people that can understand Korean because of the development of missiles in North Korea. People that can speak and understand Hindi because of nuclear tests in India. People that can speak Lingala because of the war that's going on in the Congo, for example. So there's an enormous amount of language that these people have to speak, and they haven't been able to hire the people that can do that.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is James Bamford. He is an investigative reporter. He has written now two books about the National Security Agency. The first, which was really the first major thing written about the NSA, The Puzzle Palace, was published a number of years back and sold a lot of books. More recently, he has built on that work and has a new book that's also about the National Security Agency from the Cold War through the dawn of the new century. That's the subtitle. The book is titled Body of Secrets, and it's published by Doubleday. It's in the bookstore now. He was good enough to talk with us about the book not very long ago, and it's got a lot of interesting stories in there, so you might want to take a look at it. And, of course, other sorts of questions, comments are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Mr. Bamford?
Yeah.
You still there? Oh, okay. I heard a little noise on the line. I just was afraid for the moment that somehow we might have lost you. We have a couple callers to talk with, so why don't we do that?
Sure.
We will start. We'll take them in the order they came in, and that means I think we'll start with Charleston, line four. Hello?
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. Could you say something about what the relationship is between the NSA, CIA, the Department of State and Departments of Defense, because I assume that the NSA doesn't do everything that it does on its own initiative, that it follows direction from someplace. And as a part of that, I've heard some recently, and I've been aware of it for some time, about the appalling lack of foreign language ability among our diplomats overseas, and it seems to me that the same thing is happening with some of the same possible disastrous consequences within the NSA itself. And I just wondered how these are all tied together, and thinking about maybe it would have been better in the history if we had been spending as much money on the Department of State and its objectives as we have been on the Department of Defense and its objectives. So I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Okay.
Thanks. That's a good question. Briefly, the differences between the agencies. The CIA is responsible primarily for analysis of all the intelligence picked up by other agencies, as well as the human element in espionage, sending people overseas under diplomatic cover and so forth. And then the State Department's mostly interested in diplomatic intelligence, and NSA's responsibility is eavesdropping and code-breaking worldwide. In terms of the language problem, I mean, that's absolutely right. The CIA's had the same problem, the lack of adequate language training in key areas of the world. I mean, among the problems is the fact that people going to college don't speak don't take courses in Serbo-Croatian or Lingala or Urdu in college. It's a long and expensive process to take people in and then train them for several years in these languages, but that's what they're going to have to do. NSA has had that problem for a long time, and they had, when the Cold War was on and they were targeting Russia, as the 80% of their time was going to targeting Russia, they had lots of Russian linguists coming in the front door and going out, spending 30 years at the agency and then going out the back door. But now that we're faced with crises in lots of different parts of the world almost simultaneously, the agency is not as well endowed with these linguists to handle that, and that's a major problem. If you don't understand what's going on, and you can't understand the language, and you can't read the intercepts of the local newspapers, then you're in deep trouble. And with regard to the CIA sending human spies, the situation is even worse, because the agency during the Cold War is basically geared to hire people out of college, train them for a couple of years, send them over to an embassy in some country, and then have them try to recruit local officials in that country to work for the CIA or secretly work for the CIA or sell them documents or whatever. So what it involved was basically going over to a foreign capital, living in a very nice house and attending cocktail parties and trying to recruit foreign diplomats. So trying to get people who look Afghani or look the part of the area of the world they're going to go to and speak it without any kind of foreign inflection in the voice, and telling them they're going to have to live, in a drab city in Kandahar in Afghanistan for 5 years, or live in a cave for 5 years to establish their bona fides or establish their credibility as before they can infiltrate is it's just something the CIA is not really cut out to do. So that what they mostly do is they establish very good liaison relationships with other intelligence agencies, such as the Pakistani intelligence agency, because they're in a much better position to infiltrate people into that country. So, and that's been very difficult because the Pakistani intelligence agency has been a supporter of the Taliban for a long time. So those are the complicating factors facing the intelligence community.
Let's continue. We have another caller here, someone on a cell phone, so let's go to them on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'm struck and actually rather floored by your guest's repeated references to the terrorists that we're currently facing as cave dwellers. I'm wondering if, on the one hand, that kind of naivete and virulent racism could play a role in the intelligence failure that we've experienced. And
that's
secondly,
how Bin Laden lives. I mean, if you read everything that's...
Let me ask my second part of my question and hang up. And then I'm also wondering if your guest has thought through some of these social implications of a frame for this conflict that follows from that sort of comment, which is a sort of Western civilization versus Eastern barbarism. And I'm wondering how one can possibly responsibly represent the conflict in those terms in a public forum. And I'll just hang up. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Bamford?
Well, I'm not making this up. This is exactly how they've lived. I mean, if you followed the war in Afghanistan between Russia and the Mujahideen, they lived in the mountains, the Rocky Mountains, the very difficult areas in Afghanistan, and a lot of times they lived in caves, and that's how Bin Laden's been hiding out. I mean, not always, but occasionally in caves, and they lived in caves occasionally when they were fighting the Russians during the long conflict between the Mujahideen and the Russians. So, I mean, it's not an issue of racism. It's an issue of discussing accurately how they live. I mean, I've been in that area. I've been through Afghanistan. I've been to Kandahar, which is where the Taliban is located. I've been to many places in Afghanistan, and I kind of know what it looks like there. So I think that's fairly accurate representation, not that they always live in caves or not that they spend their entire lives there. It's just that is how they are when they're hiding out from their adversaries. So with regard to the other question, it was... I really didn't follow the other part of the question. If the caller wants to re-ask it, I'd be happy to try to answer it.
Well, the caller hung up, so I think maybe it'd be better for us just to go on to the next person in line here. That would be a caller in Chicago. That'd be line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wanted to comment on this for quite a while because I've noticed that you've got a lot of guests and callers saying we can't win this war on terrorism, that we're going to have this long road and America doesn't have the will. I believe we do have the will. And I think the problem of terrorism, the reason we got caught by surprise, frankly, and I think your guest said it very well, the money for the NSA and the CIA and all has been cut so badly, and plus the fact that President Ford signed this bill against assassination. Now, I'm sorry, but when you're fighting a war against terrorism, you have to be able to go out and eliminate individuals who are going to do it to you. Americans have always been taught to play by the rules and be nice and be, not to do anything underhanded. Unfortunately, the world isn't like that, and I think we got a good dose of that last Tuesday. This problem of terrorism has been building for 25 years. As I said to another guest one time, we have a problem in this country of not dealing with, we have a habit, rather, of not dealing with a problem until it becomes a national emergency, and this has become one. I'd like to get your guest's comment on that.
Well, Mr. Bamford?
Well, I agree with him that the money should be increased for the intelligence community. I just think...
You don't think we should be able to assassinate our opponents?
I'm sorry?
You don't think we should be able to assassinate our opponents?
No, I'm against assassination.
Well, what do you think they did to us last Tuesday?
Well, I mean, if you want me to answer the question, I'll answer it. I'm against assassination. I think it's morally indefensible to go out and assassinate people. And the reason that the bill was passed was not just for moral reasons, it was for practical reasons. If you start assassinating world leaders, assassination only applies to leaders of countries and political assassinations. It doesn't.
You are aware of the fact, are you not, that we
if both of you talk at the same time, neither you can hear the other. So we'll give the caller a chance to redirect. But go ahead, Mr. Bamford.
Well, the problem is if you start allowing assassinations, you end up in the position that Israel is in right now. I mean, they've been carrying out a series of assassinations, and that surely hasn't brought peace to Israel. They carry out an assassination, and the next day there's a huge suicide bomber someplace in Tel Aviv. And they carry out another assassination, and then there's another suicide bomber. So I don't think assassination is a panacea, and I think the United States should stand for morality. We shouldn't go around assassinating people. It's just not the way I want to live in a country. In addition to that, you know, we've had presidents assassinated here, and if you start assassinating other people's presidents, we're going to be in a really bad situation in terms of not just this one incident, but many incidents of other groups trying to assassinate the president.
Okay, I'd like to respond to that. I understand you want to live in a moral country, and that's very nice. However, war isn't moral. It's immoral. You just talk to anyone who's fought in a war. And incidentally, we did assassinate people. We did it in the Second World War. We did it to a Japanese admiral. We found out where he was going to be at a certain time. We sent the airplanes out, and they shot his plane down. They killed him and his staff. So assassination is not new to this country.
Well, that was a World War II. I'm not talking about World War II.
I know, but but this is a war. We're in one now.
Well, I don't think we're in a war right now. We've had a major terrorist incident, and there's a lot of rhetoric out there, but we're not in a war at this moment.
Sir, we are. You just don't want to admit it. You like a lot
of liberals. Yeah, that's my opinion.
Like a lot of liberals, you don't want to admit it, but in fact, we are in a war right now against terrorists.
That's your opinion.
Well, fine. I'm just saying that it bothers me that I hear a lot of these liberals call and say, we can't win a war against terrorism, and we have to find a diplomatic solution, and we have to do this, and we have to do that. We're past that now.
All right, well, fine. That's your opinion.
That's
my
right.
opinion.
Thank you for listening.
All right, well, we appreciate the comments.
We should work this out some way short of World War III here. I think we can, you know, we've had terrorist incidents in the past, and we've managed to find the culprits, put them on trial, and either execute them or put them away for a long period of time, or forever. And I think that's a better solution than going after beginning a war that may end up being like Vietnam or something like that.
Well, do you think, short of lifting this ban against assassination, that intelligence agencies of this country, the CIA or anybody else, will, and as a result of this, be given greater latitude as to what they can do now?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, this assassination ban doesn't apply to bin Laden anyway. He's not a world leader. I mean, if he's killed in the attempt to capture him, if he's killed in a cruise missile attack on his headquarters, that's not an assassination. I'm talking about being against assassinations where you're going off and killing Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or something like that. So there's a definitional difference here. And I'm against that kind of assassination. I'm not opposed to, you know, if a terrorist is killed in the process of being apprehended or in the process of attacking his headquarters, then, I mean, that to me is not an assassination. So I think we've got to define the terms before we, you know, get into a more elaborate argument on the issue.
Sure. A little bit past the midpoint here, we're talking with James Bamford. He is an investigative reporter. Until recently, he was Washington investigative producer for ABC's World News Tonight. He wrote a book that came out a number of years ago that was a national bestseller when it was published. It was the first extensive look at the National Security Agency. That book was titled The Puzzle Palace. And more recently, he's published a book that builds on that and continues to look at the activities of the National Security Agency from the Cold War through the dawn of a new century. That's the subtitle. And the title of this book is Body of Secrets. It's quite interesting, published by Doubleday. In fact, we discussed the book here on Focus 580 not very long ago, and Mr. Bamford was generous enough to say he'd spend some more time with us this morning talking more generally about what the events of last week and our failure to have warning of them means for the intelligence gathering capacity for this country. We have another number of people waiting in line, and we try to accommodate as many people as possible. All we ask is that people try to be brief, and we just ask that so we can get in as many folks as we can and keep things moving along. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We have someone else in Chicago. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I can't believe that the intelligence agencies were starved for funds. They were being given $30 billion a year and counting, according to stories coming out of various congressional representatives over the years. Not only that, but former Senator Moynihan, who was on the Intelligence Oversight Committee in the Congress, any number of times said things were going very poorly because of policies and so on. By the way, the intelligence agencies were being run. And one other thing I want to, and I think this is a matter of incompetence from the top down, from the president's office, going back decades. As an instance, I have a brother who worked with NASA and he started back in the 60s and he retired about 5 years ago. And after he retired, he started telling me stories about what was going on in the agency. He said his first 4 or 5 years, the agency was run very competently. After that, everything went downhill, incompetence, stupidity, and so on. And it was only during the Clinton administration, the latter years of his administration, when things started picking up again. And I think this is where people ought to look if they're going to do investigating in these areas.
Well, in terms of budget, the reason I think that the intelligence budget should be increased is it's been decreased by a third, both in terms of personnel and money, since 1990, since the end of the Cold War.
$30 billion a year?
Well, the intelligence agencies have been decreased in like I said, money and manpower by a third, at least NSA has, since 1990. That's right.
Yeah, but you mean $30 billion a year isn't enough to cover all bases?
Well, you know, how much money do we spend on, or how are we planning to spend on the Star War program?
Well, I don't think we ought to spend anything as far as that goes on that. That's a waste.
I don't either, and I'd much rather spend, I mean, having written 2 books on NSA, I kind of know where their problems are, and the world has gotten far more complicated. It's not like it was back when we were just watching the Soviet Union and you just had this one target you were keeping an eye on. In order to watch trouble areas in a lot of different parts of the world, it's with the world changing, where you have so much communications out there, cell phones, the internet, and then language capabilities that you need in so many different parts of the world now, you're basically going to have to spend more money to get it. And I would rather spend more money to have better intelligence to prevent incidents like this, and to let them happen, and then to go to war afterwards. I mean, I'm not believe me, I'm not for spending a lot of money on defense and other things that you don't need to spend it on. But in intelligence, preventing a disaster like this is far more economical than letting it happen, and then all the implications that happen afterwards, as we can see. Not that you're going to ever prevent every single terrorist incident, but I think if the intelligence community had done things a little bit differently, and when you do those things, it does cost money. It would have, it might have deterred this, or might have found out about it beforehand. And that's all I'm saying. I mean, you've got to spend enough money in order to prevent these things from happening, so it doesn't cost more afterwards. And if I was going to take money, I'd certainly take it away from this Star Wars program. You know, targeting missiles from unknown countries that when we're fighting war of terrorism, I'd much sooner see far less money going to that and more money going to intelligence agencies.
Well, what I'm saying is that I agree with you that the money ought to be spent wisely, but I think the money hasn't been spent wisely, and for what other reason? I think that there may have been lots of corruption and very little oversight, and the stupidity of in the White House, basically, starting from there, ever since the Johnson administration, or after the Johnson administration, because when my brother went into NASA, as an example, at least while Johnson was in office, the NASA program was run very well. After that, things went to pieces. And then maybe other programs were similarly affected.
Well, I agree that there, I mentioned that in the my opening comments, that I thought this was a total failure of the intelligence community, and that there were a number of things that they should be certainly chastised for. And I think that the among the things that I mentioned was spending too little time hiring analysts and training linguists and having a culture that doesn't really fit in very well with the type of intelligence that we need today. I mean, a culture focused on Cold War issues as opposed to such as looking for missiles and so forth, as opposed to looking for terrorists. So I think those things have to change. The bottom line is I'm not willing to spend lots of money on untested missile defenses. I'd much rather spend it on early warning from the intelligence communities. And we're not talking nearly the sums that you are with these missile tests, these Star Wars missile programs.
Let's continue. We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. They are next, line number two. Hello? The caller there, line two? Perhaps not. Let's try.
Oh, hello.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
This is Champagne, not Bloomington.
Oh, pardon me. I guess what I have here on my screen says one thing, and I guess the reality is something else.
Okay, that's what you kind of caught me off guard.
My apologies. Champagne, go ahead.
Yeah, my comment is that the caller, a couple calls back, seems to me is unwittingly, you know, by wanting to respond to these acts with assassinations and massive military response, is just playing into the hands of the Bin Ladens of the world. That's exactly what they want, because going out and assassinating, Saddam Hussein, or bombing Afghanistan, doing something like that, or Pakistan, is only going to recruit thousands and thousands of more people to their cause. That's exactly the kind of thing that they're trying to provoke us to do.
Well, I agree 100%. I think that's the ultimate goal of a terrorist, is to, and especially of Bin Laden, would be to put him on the level of basically a world leader, launching a world leader involved in a war against the United States. I think treating him as as almost a co-equal opposite in a war, or in terms politically, using that politically, somebody in charge of an army attacking the United States, I think is basically what he wants. I mean, that's what most terrorists want, and I think you've got to take this a little bit slower than most people are willing to do it. At least that's my opinion. You've got to. I think you do have to show that there was a direct connection between Bin Laden and what happened here, and I haven't seen that yet. We went through a period prior to the Vietnam War where there was all this anger over this attack that took place in the Tonkin Gulf. It was called the Tonkin Gulf incident, where the United States claimed that the North Vietnamese attacked these two ships. Well, it turns out that most of that was a mistake, that that didn't really happen, and that there was a lot of lying that took place involved in that Tonkin Gulf incident. And what happened? We ended up getting in the Vietnam War. There were 50,000 people killed. So I'd be willing to wait a little bit longer and make sure that we're doing the right thing before jumping off like we did with the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which was signed by, I think, all but one or two people in Congress at the time.
Yeah, and, you know, the other aspect of it that a lot of people don't want to get into, and when you bring it up, you tend to be accused of, you know, being a self-loathing American and that sort of thing, is that I think we have to recognize that there are millions, and in fact hundreds of millions of people all around the world that have very real grievances about the policies of the United States. And it's not that they're necessarily anti-democratic, but in fact, you know, we're supporting governments and corporate actions that are very anti-democratic. I mean, many of these governments that we support wholeheartedly are not in any respect at all democratic. Certainly the Saudis aren't, you know, a number of other nations. I mean, just one right after another that engage in all kinds of repressive practices against their own people. And, you know, those people view the United States as supporting them. And that's one of the reasons they're so irritated. I think, you know, we have to do a serious examination of our foreign policy.
Well, I agree 100%. The foreign policy is almost the first line of defense because if you can work out issues diplomatically, then a lot of times it won't come down to this. The Bush administration made an enormous mistake when they first came into office by turning their back completely on the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East is a cauldron of hatred. If you can resolve those problems there, you're partway to helping resolve future terrorist incidents. So rather than turn your back on the Middle East, the administration should have been engaged from day one in trying to resolve it. It may not happen in a week or a month or even a year. But unless you start, you're never ever going to resolve anything over there. And it was just multiplying every day the problems, and I just couldn't believe that the Bush administration would take the ostrich approach and stick its head in the sand and pretend that if they didn't notice it, it would go away. Well, it's not going to go away, and I think now is a perfect opportunity to try to bring some resolution to what's happening over there.
We have about 10 minutes left here. I hope the caller will forgive me for going on because the lines are full and I want to get in some other folks. And I also, again, want to introduce our guest. We're speaking with James Bamford. He's the author of a couple of books about the National Security Agency. The most recent one that we talked about here not very long ago on Focus 580, the book is titled Body of Secrets, and it's published by Doubleday. He, until recently, was Washington investigator producer for ABC's World News Tonight. He has written investigative cover stories for several publications, including the magazines of The New York Times, The Washington Post, and The LA Times. And he makes his home in Washington, D.C. This morning, we're talking about some of the intelligence implications of the terrorist attacks last week and the failure apparently to have any warning that they were going to occur and what that means for U.S. intelligence gathering. And was very generous on a very short notice to say he would be our guest this morning on the program. We have a number of other callers here, and we'll continue. We'll try to get in as many folks as we can in the time that remains. As I say, we have about 10 minutes left. Next person in line is, this is Bloomington, Indiana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Mr. Bamford, I also want to ask you about your opinion of assassination. That previous caller, you criticized Israel for engaging in what you called assassination, and you referred to the suicide bombing which prompted the assassinations as if those suicide bombings and the assassinations they prompted were morally equivalent. So here's my first question. Is the indiscriminate mass murder caused by a suicide bomber, is that morally equivalent to surgical assassination of the man who ordered the suicide bombing? Are those two acts morally equivalent?
Well, I don't want to get into a semantic discussion here. What I'm saying that is if you assassinate somebody, there's a good chance that you're going to be receiving a bomb at some point from somebody else. And if you assassinate somebody else, you're going to get another bomb. It's a nasty way to live, and I don't particularly want to live in a country where we assassinate somebody and they assassinate somebody over here, and it's just not the way I want to live. But I don't have time to get into a long semantic difference on whether if you bomb here.
Let me put the question this way then, about the terrorist act against the United States. If we can determine that those terrorist attacks, which were accomplished by suicide terrorists, if we can determine that Osama bin Laden ordered that suicide terror, and we determine that it was militarily effective to assassinate Osama bin Laden, it was effective. Now, I don't know whether it would be effective or not, but let's assume that it was, we determined it was. Would our assassination of Osama bin Laden be morally equivalent to what he did to us?
I don't know if it's morally equivalent. Philosophical discussions.
You don't know whether it's morally equivalent?
What I'm saying is if we find out that he was involved in this, if he was directing this, then I don't have any problem with in the process of reacting to that in the way of cruise missiles or whatever, or he dies in the midst of a gunfight and trying to capture him, I don't have any problem with that. I'm talking assassination deals with world leaders. You know, if a mafia figure gets killed in the process of being captured, or he's holding people hostage and he gets shot by a sniper, that's not assassination. So I don't want, you know, we can get into semantics for 5 hours here and have a nice college discussion of semantics.
Yeah, but
I'm just talking about assassination the way it's legally defined, and legally defined means assassinating world leaders, not killing people, terrorists in the midst of a gunfight or a cruise missile battle or something.
Sir, wouldn't you say that our response, we Americans are going to respond to the terrorist that acts against us? Isn't it important that we respond morally?
Well, I've said I wanted to respond morally. Yes.
Yeah, I think the call you're now basically asked the same question three times, and I think I'm not suggesting that it's not an appropriate question, but I think it just seems for this particular discussion, it seems to lie outside of the territory we have tried to stake out.
Okay.
Well, let's go on to another caller, and let's see, Carmel, I think, line number three.
Yes, I'm here.
Yes.
I agree with you. We don't have the right to go around the world and kill nation leaders. What was the reason to kill the leader of Chile and kill innocent people there? And we know who did it. And Jimmy Carter said on a television conference, what Nixon and Mr. Kissinger did, that would have never happened in Chile. We know who did it. So, well, you tell me, Chile, I mean, a little bitty country, was going to come here and kill Mr. Nixon and Kissinger? I mean, that's funny. That's even something to laugh at. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I agree 100% that we shouldn't kill leaders of other countries. And
well, the other man was talking about that. I'd like to rebut that.
Yeah, oh, certainly. Oh, well, we hear your comment, and I think it sounds to me as if the guest here that we have is pretty much in agreement with you.
Right. That's what. The program is to tell your view.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
I was very opposed to what happened there, and I think that should be investigated. I think it is going to. I think the family is suing Henry Kissinger over this now, it's a bit out of my area, so I don't want to talk about it too much.
I would like
I
to
know a lot about NSA and the CIA.
Together with Pinochet, maybe.
but anyway, I'm morally and philosophically opposed to the.
I understand, and I applaud that.
Assassination, and if somebody in the U.S. was involved in that, I'd love to see him go to court and be tried for it.
All right. Well, thank you for the comment. I want to try and squeeze maybe one more person in here, if that's possible. We'll go to Charleston, and it's line four. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about the kind of the technical technology race between the ease of encrypting emails using your email service versus the NSA's ability to decrypt it. And secondly, going from an analog to a digital age, the real practical difficulties of intercepting communications, say, through fiber optic networks, whether maybe NSA is becoming somewhat less relevant.
Well, that's a good question, and that's been a discussion that's gone on for a while now. It basically comes down to the question of, is NSA going deaf? The reason for that is because, as you mentioned, this shift in technology from analog, which is what NSA had been geared for a long time, to digital, and the problem with digital communications a lot of times is your communications don't always go the same way. This phone call may be going one way, 5 minutes later another phone call will be going different ways, different packets and so forth. So it's much, technologically, it's much more difficult to intercept communications, to eavesdrop on communications. At the same time, there was a time when encryption was limited to major countries or large corporations, and now anybody can buy encryption, including Bin Laden. For $100 or a couple hundred dollars, you can buy encryption packages. And from what I understand, Bin Laden has not only been involved in encryption to some degree, but involved in a thing called steganography, which is where you actually hide the message in a picture, for example. So you don't even know that there's a message out there. With encryption, you know there's a message. You just can't read it because it's all scrambled. But steganography, you're actually hiding the actual message in some pixels or something on a picture or in a corner of a video on a being sent over the internet or something. So you're making life far more difficult for the people trying to intercept this communications. Also, when you're dealing with terrorist organizations like Bin Laden's organization, it's an organization that's pretty much along blood ties, family ties, clan-type organization, where everybody sort of has known each other or known their families for years. And a lot of times you can have messages passed by couriers and so forth. You don't need this sort of massive command structure that you had in Russia or other places where you target certain, what they call nodes, where you know certain communications are going to be going in and coming out. Here they're mobile. They don't use communications that often. It's a lot of by word of mouth and courier. So it makes life very, very much more difficult for the people at NSA and the people trying to collect this information.
We're going to have to leave it at that because we've come right here to the end of the time. Mr. Bamford, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time today and talking with us.
No, I enjoyed it. Thanks, Dave.
Our guest, James Bamford, and again, if you're interested in looking at the book that I've mentioned a couple of times here, his new book about the National Security Agency, the title is Body of Secrets, and it's published by Doubleday.